Oregon. Oh, Eastern Oregon. Flourishing. Oh, my gosh.
Okay, sweet. Oh, here it is. I got it on Tuesday.
Oh, Tuesday. Okay.
Ready on the right?
Just a little more money.
Ready on left. All right. Good morning, everyone. Call to order the January 14th, 2010 meeting of the House Interim Subcommittee on Workforce Development. We have a bill, a couple of legislative concepts, and an informational meeting this morning. I understand that with regard to our apprenticeship requirements, legislative concept 145, we may have some witnesses that would appreciate getting out of here early. And with that, I am going to open a public hearing on legislative concept number 145. And do we have a sign-up sheet for...
We will get that. In the meantime, I can do a short synopsis of the concept.
Okay, if you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. LC 145 directs the State Apprenticeship and Training Council to adopt rules that will allow a local committee to determine the circumstances in which an apprentice electrician who has completed specified hours of apprenticeship training to work, which as outlined in the concept, without direct supervision during the remainder of the apprenticeship.
Thank you very much, Teresa. Appreciate that. We have signed up on this one, Dave Baker and Nathan Phillips. Dave, if you come, would you like to come up together? Would that be beneficial? Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to our subcommittee.
Morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This bill is in response to a change that we asked for in the... I think it was in the 06 session where we...
Excuse me, would you please introduce yourself for the record?
I'm Nathan Phillips. I live in Eugene, and I'm an electrical contractor. We asked for this change to reduce the amount of training required for limited energy electricians from 8,000 hours to 6,000 hours because of the scope of training that was necessary and the need to get more manpower into that industry. And when that bill was passed, we didn't really think about the work alone requirements that we have now. We've always let our apprentices in the last period of their training or the last year of their training work alone on small jobs. And by rule in the electrical licensing world, jobs are limited to 8 hours or less. So guys get to go out and do service calls and small things like that to get some training. Well, in the way the rules were written, when we reduced the training from 8,000 hours to 6,000 hours, it was in the last 1,000 hours of the 8,000-hour program. Well, they've already turned out by then, so we lost the ability to have apprentices work alone and get this training. So this is really just a simple thing to fix that oversight.
So Nathan, just to really focus in and nail this down, this is not a new concept of work alone. This is just a proportional number because we changed the total number of hours. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
We've done it for, I don't know when, when I started in the trade, we were doing it. So
okay.
It's been a long time.
Very good. Very good. Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. Dave Baker, Training Director for Central Electrical Training Center, located in Tangent, Oregon. We are a union apprenticeship program for electricians.
And you're in support of...
That is correct, Mr. Chair. Like Nathan had mentioned, when they move their hours, usually it's a requirement for the apprentices. It's a way to enhance your education and training, and doesn't mean that they're going to be working alone. They have to earn that from the contractor because the contractor has to have faith and their abilities to be out there working by themselves, because that's their representative that they have.
Okay, and Dave, your apprenticeship programs have entertained this work alone provision for some period of time?
Correct.
Okay,
correct.
Very good. Are either of you gentlemen aware of anyone that is opposed to this measure?
I don't believe so, Mr. Chair. We brought this up in the last session. It sort of procedurally didn't make it through, and there weren't any problems then. It just got caught up in the process.
Very good. Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions or comments from the subcommittee? I'm not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you so very, very much. Is there anyone else from the public that would like to comment on LC 145 at this time? Going once, twice, three times? Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on LC 145 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3600.
Yes.
All right. And Teresa, would you please give us a brief review of that bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill may look familiar to you members, as this is a redraft of House Bill 2745 from the 2009 session. The measure allows counties to charge an additional fee for premium services in excess of the actual cost of processing a development review permit, and requires the county, prior to charging this fee, to adopt a premium fee schedule and standards for justifying the fee. The measure also establishes a sunset date of January 2, 2015.
Representative Esquivel, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. This bill, I believe, passed the House 58-0. It was as much my fault as anyone's fault. We lost it in the Senate because of unawareness on the Senate side that the bill was in the particular committee. And so, therefore, everything's lined up on this bill. You will see what this bill is it allows your counties, and it's a permissive bill. It's not a mandatory bill. It allows your counties to establish what we call a fast track for a permitting process. They have to establish a fee, and they have to establish a alternative tracking. So if you come in as a developer, you want to get started rapidly, you can either go through the standard, which is still in place. They cannot deteriorate that standard. They cannot force you to go into the fast track. They cannot force you to pay any more. They still have to have in place their particular standard process for permitting and their time frames as well. But this is kind of an experimental in the aspect that you see it has a sunset. So therefore, we're going to allow counties to establish this program, establish an additional fee. And my understanding in my county, what they're going to do is allow this to be farmed out into the private sector to fast-track it right away. So if they do not have the particular personnel on board, they will take it into the private sector and allow them to go through to make sure that all the I's are dotted and the D's are crossed. Any questions? Pretty simple bill, actually.
Seems like a fairly simple bill. Representative Greenlight?
Thank you. Sal, I'm looking at the 215-416. It says notwithstanding. Why is it notwithstanding that? Because there are fees established in that?
Well, see, there's no fees established at this point. They have to establish the fee first.
Oh, man.
And then they have to establish the program.
But why does it say that? I mean, what is there in 215-416 that has to be not withstood?
I don't know. You have to ask LC that question. I couldn't answer that. And God only knows what LC does, Representative Greenlake.
I'm going to be addressing that very topic in a moment, Representative Esquivel. I have a burr under my saddle on another topic. Any further questions?
Vice Chair Huffman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Esquivel, I was just wondering if we could expand this to municipalities. I just recently received a building permit that took a couple of days longer than I think maybe it should have taken to get, and so it would have been nice to have had a fast-track option.
Representative Huffman, when we say a couple of days, what do we actually mean by a couple of days?
You could add almost two zeros on behind that.
There you go.
It was a lengthy process.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, the problem is in our system is, and I'm going to give you a fine example of this in my municipality. It was on a bringing in a piece of property into the city. And I went in and asked the people in planning, well, okay, how does this system work? And they said, well, you have to do this, and that takes this many days, and then you have to do this, and it takes that many days. And my first question on the first 30 days or 60 days, whatever it was, I said, well, why do we do that? Well, there was a dead silence. Well, we've always done it that way, I see. But I said, what's the purpose? I don't know. We've just always done it that way. Okay. Then so we moved to the next step. And my next question was, well, why do we do this? And so the planner just started grinning and said, well, I'll tell you what, let me get back with you. So that individual went back and cut the time frame down exactly in half by things that we had layered on to that system for reasons no one could even remember or knew of. But they cut that system down in half, exactly half, just by stopping and asking the question, why do we do that and is it necessary? So we sometimes are our own worst enemy. And what this bill does, it allows us to have an alternative method to pay a little extra, which the developers, I might add, in my community brought this up with my county and said, would you please have some sort of a system where we can do this? We don't mind paying extra, but the time frame is what hurts us. And so that's why this is here today. But more importantly, I think this is about service. Why does it take so long? We need to reevaluate that. Why we do what we do, we need to reevaluate that. Because you'll find in your own municipality, just like in mine, like the annexation process in Medford was so cumbered by things we'd done in the past that no one had known for many years why we had done those, why the time frames were in place. It's just we've always done it that way. So I would go back and ask your municipality, why do we do it that way, and what was the purpose?
Thank you. Very good point. Before we lose sight of this specific instance, I think, not to in any way minimize the inconvenience that Vice Chair Huffman suffered in his application, that is an inconvenient pain in the neck when we have to go through it individually. But my concern is, if we have a process that takes 2 and 3 months to go through this process for a relatively simple permit, such as his was, what kind of business opportunities are we losing in this state when we allow that kind of bureaucracy to absolutely stifle potentially some opportunities? There are, I have to believe, Representative Esquivel, many companies who may be considering a construction project, and they can many times build it in a number of different locales, and if we allow a system to take inordinate amount of time for the permitting process, they may choose to go elsewhere. We know too well, I think, recent experience with the economy here in this state that we can ill afford to be losing business opportunities. And I think your bill may go a long ways in helping to accommodate businesses that have a construction schedule and very legitimate, well thought out, sustainable projects. So,
Mr. Chair, thank you for kind of tapping into that, because I was on the Southern Oregon Regional Economic Development Board for 8 years. I was the past president and past vice president of that board. And what we did is we had to think of ways around our system in the state of Oregon. We had what we called a grant system, where we would allow people to go ahead and apply for shovel-ready sites. We would pay the cost up front, Southern Oregon Regional Economic Development, in the form of a grant. And then when they would have an individual that came in that was interested in that particular location, the permit process, a year of the work was done, because we had already established that shovel-ready permit process in place. A lot of people can't afford that, so we did it in the form of a grant. As soon as they sold the property and or transformed the property or entered into a lease, transferred it or whatever, then it was immediately paid out of escrow So we had ways in place to establish a way for a payback. But more importantly, we had those sites ready. But it's coming right back to what you're saying, Mr. Chair, is why do we have to think of ways to circumvent our own system in the state of Oregon in order to make it better? There's a lot of time frames, and you'll find in your municipality, just like I found in my municipality, that when they establish a time frame, that gives the opportunity to say, okay, we're going to put 90 days on here, and guess what? We don't approach that for 89 days. Instead of saying, okay, we have 90 days to do this, let's get it done in the first week. And that's just a fact of life. What we need to do, if you want economy to boom in this state, if you want people to come into this state, you have to have shovel-ready sites. You have to have a process to where people can come in, where they can get a permit, and they can go about their merry business and start building and start putting people back to work. The way we have it established today, that's not the case. That's just a fact of this state. I have had people tell me that we're coming to this place in spite of your rules. And that's a pretty sad thing to say to you. But I have had companies tell me that. So the best, what we can do as legislators is try to get the best environment, try to get the best way of where we can entice people. It doesn't do any good to have great, great incentives to bring people here if it takes them 2 years to get a permit. Because time's money.
Well, and on that point, Representative Esquivel, I think that maybe sometimes we need a different mindset, that the permitting process could be viewed by all of us as an opportunity for business to come in and show us how good they are and how good their project is. And the top-notch construction projects and the top-notch workforce that we have available here in our state, and for them to be able to come in and say, you know, we are the best, here's a great project, and the process of permitting is just one to make sure that all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, as they should be.
Granted, I agree with that 100%, but see, it seems like we should have a process where you walk in, I don't care who you are, you walk in and you say, okay, I want to do da-da-da-da-da.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm here to help you to get you to that process instead of I'm out here throwing hurdles up in front of you for you to overcome. I think we lose sight of we're there to service people. We're there to give them a service. We're there to help people get to their ultimate goal instead of throwing those hurdles out in front. And it depends upon your municipality. It depends upon the individuals.
Thank you very much, Representative Esquivel. Very important statement. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Esquivel, I appreciate the intent of this bill and support the idea of it for sure. It would be great to have faster permits to get people to work much quicker. I found myself sitting collecting unemployment for some time waiting for a permit to happen. But albeit, you know, I know the counties are really strapped with budgets and whatnot, and I realize that it's difficult for them and understand this may be a way to get around that, perhaps by contracting out this process for a premium price. But I guess...
They don't have to.
But, you know, one of my concerns, I guess, is in Representative Huffman's case, you know, he... So, for example, we allow these premium, fee schedules for premium services, and Representative Huffman can't afford the premium that's set because it's not really laid out how much more that'll be, and I'm worried that his project will continue to slide off as they deal with the ones that pay more for the permit. So, you know, I guess the bigger, more people with more money to invest in that permit may, in fact, get special treatment where Representative Huffman may now have to wait 400 days instead of 200. And so I'm just worried about the equity there, because I believe everybody that applies for a permit should be getting premium services like you, although that's not happening. So I just have a few little things to work through with that to make sure that we're not just throwing Representative Huffman's project on a back burner that's even colder than the one it is now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I believe in the bill it states that they have to maintain what they currently have. So you're going to have nothing worse than you have today. This is just an extra. You have a certain process in place within your municipality and or your county today that is a certain timeline, and they're required by law to have those timelines, whether it be through state law and or ordinances. And they are established today. They cannot defer from that criteria in this bill. This does not allow them to say, okay, Representative Huffman, you have to go to this. We're going to bump you up into this, and it's going to cost you more. They cannot do that. Representative Huffman will still be in the same system. He's not going to be out anything more or less than he is today. But he will have an option to go and say, okay, I'm going to give an extra 10% here, and I get it done in half the time. But he has that option, and that's what this is about, options.
Not a chance.
Can I just... Representative Dembrough, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on that, that sort of gets me thinking, Representative, what happens if, you know, aside from this whole process, budgets decline at the county level and, you know, employees are laid off, which is going to lengthen the process, you know, presumably for a permit to go through. How can you guarantee that the current timelines will be maintained under that unknown scenario?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dembrough, if you're familiar at all with the system, you can't do that.
Oh, it's a Senate bill.
Because if you violate a time frame, that individual gets their permits. Because you have established time frames that you cannot go over that time frame.
Additional questions or comments? Not seeing any. Representative Esquivel, thank you very much. Very important item in terms of business development here in the state. I'm seeing that there may be members of the public who would like to testify. Please come forward. Good morning, Bill. If you'd please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, sir. Thank you. Chair, for the record, Bill Flitting, Carpenters Industrial Council. I can give you one small example of what can happen. The town of Monmouth, the junction of 99 and Highway 51. A corner lot, which was once residential homes, Walgreens drugstore wanted to build a large store. 3 years, it went through all the land use agencies. I don't want to bring up any names, but it turned out there was just three families that didn't even live in the area, protested, and through the three-year period, the people who lived in this block sold their homes out. The homes were demolished. But the third time she started through the land use appeals, just last year, Walgreens says, we're out of here. We're done. So there sits an empty lot. The building trades could have built that store. There could have been a dozen people working in that store today. But there sits an empty lot. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this out. That's just one small example. And right now, the town of Monmouth needs a few jobs, so thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Kluding? Thank you very much, Bill. Certainly appreciate that addition to the record. Anyone else from the public that would like to testify on House Bill 3600 this morning? Not seeing any. I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3600.
And I am going to open a public hearing on Legislative Concept 117. Teresa, could you give us some background, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. LC 117 expands the definition of public works under Oregon's prevailing wage law to include the construction or installation of individual or combination of devices, structures, or mechanisms that use solar radiation for generating energy on land, premises, structures, or buildings that are owned by a public body. The concept allows the Bureau of Labor and Industries to take any action before the concept's operational date of January 1st, 2011, which is necessary to implement and manage the provisions of the concept. There is an emergency clause on the concept effective upon passage.
Very good. Thank you. At this point, I would like to call up, please, Dave Baker, Bob Shiprack, and Joe Esmond, please. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
Dave Baker, Train Director, Central Electrical Training Center, located in Tangent.
Look, don't go like that. You can just have your comments.
I'll defer.
Okay. I'll lead it off then, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Good morning, Bob.
Dave's kind of new to this process, and he'll get used to it, though. I'm Bob Shiprack, Executive Secretary, Oregon Building Trades Council, and I'll have some brief comments today. The intent of this legislation is to try and clarify when prevailing wages would apply to solar installations only on public properties. There was a wage determination several months ago over a project in the city of Portland, Multnomah County, actually. Many people disagreed with that determination. So in order to clarify the issue, we are coming to the legislature, as we are wont to do. There's a lot of different financing mechanisms going on right now. This is, you know, we all know solar industry is getting started in Oregon in a big way. And there's various schemes out there to, put these installations on public buildings. And one of the things that I would disagree somewhat with the concept that there are no public funds involved in these installations. In fact, I met with Mark Long, the head of the Department of Energy, who actually told us, he says, in his opinion, the public pays twice for these installations, in that oftentimes the developers use business energy tax credits to help provide the installation, and then the public agency itself pays through the electricity generated. And oftentimes these contracts, after a time certain, the installation reverts to the ownership of the public agency itself. So that goes on. So that's why we want to get this clarified. There's a lot of public funds involved here. In fact, just for your benefit, Mr. Long has suspended the use of those Betsy tax credits on these types of installations for that very reason, that the public is paying twice. The other thing in the bill that I really want to have a chat with Legislative Council about is that they're amending the a term of art that's been in those statutes for decades, which has to do with contracted for or carried on by. There's a great deal of case law around this. As many of you know, you start changing some of the words in a public contracting code, you can have unintended effects, and I certainly don't want to see that. In closing, I would also ask that I just saw the letter from Boley. There are things that they have raised that have to be discussed so that we have a good piece of legislation for you. I'd like an opportunity to work through those issues and give you a good product that meets the needs of the industry and the public. So that's my question.
Mr. Chair, can I ask Representative Green?
Can I answer your question?
Please do.
It looks like the LC took the opportunity to
clean up technical language.
Yes.
So the first question is the substance of what we're talking about this D on the top of page 4? Or maybe I can ask. Shipwreck that.
It is, Mr. It is, and Representative Greenlee. Yes.
But I think Mr. Shipwreck was suggesting something in those earlier cleanups mm-hmm. that's causing problems. I wonder if you could point to what that is.
No. I'm sorry if I gave you that. I'm talking about just that specific, as you want to call it, a cleanup. And LC does that. I just want to have an opportunity, however, to vet that with legislative council so that we do not have unintended
didn't
consequences.
Didn't accidentally change something.
Exactly, Mr. Okay. Chair, Representative Green. No unintended consequences.
Yes, please, Teresa.
I can point out to you, Representative Green, like consider as a committee, and I did speak to a full number of the stakeholders about this. We do have a little bit of time between now and when we do have to drop this LC upon permission from the Speaker for bill introduction. So if it is something that's a cleanup, I mean, again, it's upon determination with counsel, with the drafter, if there is time, but that is something that I can look into right away and see if we can fix it before in bill introduction.
And Representative Greenlee, I'm not going to miss this opportunity because I asked for this bill, and it was my signature that went down to LC to have this bill drafted. And when it came back, I didn't even recognize page 3, and there's an entire page of changes that I didn't ask for. And quite frankly, I resent the fact that this bill would have been hijacked without my knowledge. And I can well understand LC's desire at times to want to clean up language. But it would be nice to know that they were going to do this. And a simple phone call to myself or the folks that are interested in the bill would have been nice, and that courtesy wasn't extended. And I can tell you that the chair resents this. I resent the fact that it was a change without my knowledge. I resent the fact that it probably caused some concern at the Bureau of Labor and Industries unnecessarily. And I think there's a lesson to be learned here that just giving folks a heads up of what you're intending to do goes a very long ways in making the public process work a heck of a lot more smoothly. With that editorial comment, I'm going to shut up and let the process move. But as I said earlier, I have a burr under my saddle here. And the next time LC wants a bill, they can submit a bill request to one of us legislators, and they can have their own bill drafted. In addition, mark my words, if we're going to have this language changed back to the way it was supposed to have been, I'm going to have to send another note down to have them change what I didn't want in my bill in the first place.
Enough said. But notwithstanding that, anything in those first three pages that do anything except clean up language?
That's correct. That's okay. My understanding, Representative mm-hmm. Greenlee. Further questions or comments? Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shipwreck, I fully support this concept. I agree that these installations are going on public buildings, and whether they're leased or not, there are public funds involved, it seems to me. But part of the thing that troubles me is I don't know that it's in this particular bill, is that I think in 2007, as you know, we passed a prevailing wage bill that basically claimed that tax credits are not public funds,
mm-hmm.
and that's, you know, in our current statute. So it seems to me that we ought to be changing that and taking that piece back out that I think previous to 2007 was not in the ORS, is that the tax credits, to me, are public funds, and we should, as a legislature, recognize that. And I think that would go a little ways to helping this situation.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond.
Please.
I and Representative Holvey, you're correct. There's a lot of different tax credits out there, but clearly, as you folks all know, the business energy tax credit, it comes right out of the state's general fund. I mean, that's how it's paid for. And at the time, that was a program that was barely getting started. I don't even know if it was in place at that time, 2007, probably a very small program. Now it's very large and probably going to get smaller, but I couldn't agree more. I agree with that.
Additional questions? Not seeing any. Joe?
Maybe one.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joe Esmond. I'm a business agent for the IBEW Local 48, and most of my work is around the green energy stuff, what I call green stuff. I just want to let you know, and I support everything, of course, what Bob says, because he's 6 foot four, and my member paying dues. But
that's right.
We are working closely with Boley for the fix to get it cleaned up, get the intent of what you proposed squared away. So, and very cognizant of the law of unintended consequences. Thank you for your time.
And I'll give you that note to get that fixed up too, Joe. So thank you, Dave.
Just to add, from a technical standpoint, Mr. Chair. Oh, I'm sorry, Dave Baker. Just to add for a technical point reference, these installations require a lot of training, safety training also as part of that. They're dealing with an energy-producing piece of equipment that goes up on a roof that can whack them with about 300 volts DC.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's part of the reason why we think that's a good idea to ensure that there's that payback into the training portion of the individual doing the installation.
Okay, very good. Last chance. Anything further?
Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Certainly
thank you.
Appreciate it. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Kate Newhall. Kate, before you begin, my apologies for anything that's appeared in this bill without my intention.
No worries, Mr. Terwitt. We understand and I think have been in pretty constant communication with the proponents of this bill and understand exactly what happened and that was not the intent of the proponents or the drafters of the bill. So with that, I'm inviting, if it's all right with the chair, members of the committee, Christy Hammond, who is our administrator of the Wage and Hour Division, which includes the prevailing wage unit at the Bureau of Labor and Industries, who is our encyclopedia on prevailing wage law. So thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Oh, for the record, my name is Kate Newhall with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today on LC 117, which, as you heard in the panel before us, attempts to apply prevailing wage rate law to certain solar installation projects. The Bureau does appreciate the opportunity to be a technical resource to both the committee and to the concept's proponents as this legislation is considered. We do understand that the intent of this concept is to apply prevailing wage law to solar installation projects that take place on public lands, structures, or buildings, even if no funds of a public agency, as currently defined in law, are used in the project, and the project doesn't meet the definition of what is a public work. As you all well know, Oregon's PWR law requires workers on public construction projects to be paid wages and benefits found to be prevailing for the work performed in the same locality. Typically, projects are covered by PWR law if they meet both of the following criteria, which we often refer to as the two-part test. The project has to qualify as a public work, as it's defined in the law, which essentially is that the project is, back to this language that we were just talking about, the project is carried on or contracted for by a public agency, and that the project utilizes funds of a public agency. Additionally, a project must not meet any of the exemptions that are found in PWR law, which includes the exemption for projects that use no funds of a public agency. As we understand the nature of the projects that this concept intends to cover, they are not installations that are currently carried on or contracted for by a public agency, and as such, don't meet the definition of public works. As was mentioned, the predetermination that I think brought this issue up was one requested by Multnomah County on solar power agreement projects, and I actually brought that predetermination with me today if folks are interested in it. But as the predetermination spells out, since these projects don't meet the definition of a public work and don't utilize any funds of a public agency, Boley can't apply current PWR law to these projects. Now, back to the LC. By specifically amending, and I'm just going to go through, I think, what you've heard, the technical concerns that we have with it. by specifically, the concept does specifically amend the definition of a public work to include these particular projects in that definition. So they would meet the first part of the two-part test being a public work. But LC 117 doesn't amend the exemptions found in ORS 279C 810 and would still be exempt from PWR law under the funds of a public agency exemption. And I'm not going to go into too much detail, but the last point that I want to raise in my testimony, I think we already hit on, but we do have a concern with the unrelated changes that were made to the definition of a public works. And I think unrelated to the intent and the nature of this concept that made changes to the carried on or contracted for by a public agency. The reason that we have concern with what we believe to be grammatical changes that were intended to improve the language there is that there's significant case law and legislative history relating to the development of this law. And as such, we're not sure how the new language might be interpreted by the courts and how it might impact PWR enforcement. And so last, in closing, we have shared these concerns with the proponents of the bill and are happy to work with them to better achieve their intent. And in fact, it sounds like we're probably going to be doing that today. We certainly appreciate the opportunity to be involved in the drafting of this concept and the opportunity to review it and provide comment. Thank you, and with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much, Kate. I'm glad to see that you're working on it today, and you would make me infinitely happy if that's all cleaned up before February 1, and I thank you for your efforts in making that happen. Questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. Thank you both very, very much. Oh, Representative Holby, excuse me.
Thank you. I would like a copy of that predetermination if you could provide that. That would be great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anyone else from the general public who would like to testify on LC 117? I'm not seeing anyone, and I will close the public hearing, today's public hearing on LC 117.
Thank you, Mrs. Sultan. That way I can take care of this other issue as well.
Okay. I'm going to recess the subcommittee here for roughly 10 minutes until our witnesses for the informational meeting on employment-related daycare show up. So if folks would hang nearby when they show up, I'm going to reconvene. Thanks very much.
And a note for the record that Representative Riley has joined us this morning. Dias? Our committee and subcommittee in the past have entertained at length the importance of making sure that we have adults in the workforce. We've even discussed the need to attract people to re-enter the workforce, and a number of challenges that parents face. And so our next panel, I think, will be addressing those circumstances quite directly, talking about employment-related daycare. So I'd like to welcome you to our subcommittee this morning, and please decide among yourselves what order you'll proceed.
Good morning. Chair Witt and members of the committee, my name is Roberta Weber. I'm a researcher in the Family Policy Program at Oregon State University. And we thank you for the opportunity to share with you information on child care as an economic development force and the critical role that employment-related daycare plays in that. So I'm going to begin the panel with talking about the industry itself as an economic force and the impact that ERDC plays in that. Ellen Scott from the University of Oregon is going to share with you some findings from current research about just how employment-related daycare works in the lives of employers' workers. And then Deborah Murray, the Executive Director of Peninsula's Children's Center, will describe ERDC impacts on low-wage employees and on child care facilities. So in terms of child care and its interface with the economy, it's got three major points that I want to make. First, it generates income and it creates jobs, and more than most people think. Secondly, investing in disadvantaged children has been shown to have one of the highest economic impacts of any other workforce strategy that has been found. And third, child care enables a large number of parents to work while meeting the developmental needs of their children. So I'm going to address each very briefly. According to an economic impact study that was done by OSU in 2005 and is being replicated right now, the child care and education industry generates $639 million a year, more than milk production, advertising firms, or gas stations. It employs almost 15,000 workers, putting it on a par with greenhouses and nurseries and private colleges and universities. So that's a direct impact. It also directly impacts workforce in a more long-term and a direct way. James Heckman, the Nobel laureate at the University of Chicago, has documented in numerous publications that early education represents the most cost-effective workforce development strategy available. They have both high benefit ratios and rates of return. Then if you look at another more direct impact and more immediate, I would say, you'd be looking at the economic impact of the federal dollars that the state brings in, the Child Care and Development Fund. In Kansas, a state slightly smaller than Oregon, they actually did an analysis and found that a loss of $3.3 million in CCDF funds, is what they're called, was estimated to result in a direct loss of 217 jobs and an additional loss of $3.2 million to the economy in addition to the loss of the federal dollars. We're talking about the looming cut of five times that much. And so we could just multiply the analysis that was done in Kansas, and it would be likely to what we will see in Oregon. In terms of child care as a support for parental employment, over 90,000 Oregon parents rely on child care in order to work, and they generate about $2.6 billion annually from their work. Child care prices, though, put child care out of the reach for low-wage workers, even though the wages we pay to the people who work in this field are nowhere commensurate with the education and skill level that we need to really support the development of children. It's very close to minimum wage, just slightly above minimum wage is what people in this field average. In Oregon, the cost to a parent for center care for a toddler averages $9,840, which represents 60% of a minimum wage worker's annual income. It's also an amount that exceeds what we charge as tuition in our public universities. Attached to your testimony is a profile of the state of Oregon in terms of child care, where you can, but and also slipped in are your county's profiles so that you can see how these factors play out in your own geographic area. Now I want to talk about the role that ERDC itself plays in the support of low-wage workers. So it's a problem for all workers, but for low-wage workers, it can be insurmountable. Without it, they can't access child care facilities in their community. They're just out of range. Some low-wage workers do have family members or close friends who will do it without pay. But there is a substantial number of low-wage workers who either don't have family and friends near enough that they could do it, or who themselves need income in order to survive, so that there's no way they can do it because then they didn't have the resources for their own needs. For these families, ERDC is essential to employment. They really don't have great choices. Research is, and Oregon research, work that we've done at OSU, has demonstrated an association. So as parents use child care subsidy programs stably, their employment is more stable. And that same finding has been found in other states. And now the study that Ellen is going to report to you shows the details of why that is true and how that takes place. The current budget that now is facing includes a major cut to ERDC in July, and it will have impact almost 3,000 families, over about 5,500 children. We say this program is that people can use it. I mean, it's true. They're eligible up to 185% of poverty. But the families who are actually using it, they only average $595 a month in their income. These families can't access. With those kind of wages, there's no way they can access the child care in their community. So they're left with no good choices if they lose the subsidy. Some will leave their children alone. Others will try and piece together patchwork of somebody will take them for a few hours here, somebody will take them for a few hours there, and try to put it together. Job performance undoubtedly will be negatively impacted as they struggle over how to make it work, and a certain percentage of them simply are not going to be able to manage. And so what we'll see is loss of employment, either through they give up because they can't make it manage, or they get fired because their job performance has decreased as they tried to figure out how in the world to meet their children's needs. Failing to fund ERDC through the current biennium threatens to add Oregonians to both the unemployment and the welfare rolls. ERDC impacts not only the economic stability, though, of these families, but the productivity of businesses and local economies throughout the state. It also brings millions of dollars into Oregon that will be certainly threatened by a cut of the size that is now in the budget. At a time when Oregon most needs families to remain employed, it is critical to save the employment-related daycare program.
Representative Witt and members of the committee, my name is Ellen Scott, and I'm on the faculty at the University of Oregon in the Department of Sociology, and I also head Women's Studies. Since last February, I've been conducting interviews with working families who do receive employment-related daycare subsidies. And in those interviews, we review quite in depth their employment histories as well as their histories of child care arrangements. And we also talk with them about other options that they might have for child care if they were to lose their current subsidy for child care. I don't have the time to give you the details that those interviews reveal about their lives. I'll give you just a snippet of what we've been finding. But the interviews make absolutely explicit a number of things. One, most families do not have access to family, friends, and neighbors who could provide the child care for free. Indeed, the child care subsidies provide a job and an income both for those providing the child care, whether they are family, friends, neighbors, and licensed providers, and of course they assure the job for the person with the subsidy. So two, if the families lose their subsidy, they will lose their child care, and they cannot afford to pay market rates for child care. Most of the families that we interviewed earn, as Bobby just mentioned, far below the federal poverty level. Indeed, the families that we've interviewed earn $800 to $1,200 a month at best. And, of course, market rates for child care, particularly for several children in a family, far exceed that. So they would have to spend their entire month's income just to pay for child care, leaving all of their other needs unmet. And finally, if they lose their child care, they say they will have to quit their jobs. It is really that simple. Of course, if 2,900 families lose their subsidies and thus their child care and their jobs, we will undoubtedly see an increase in the TANF rolls, and of course that is a very expensive route for us to take as a state. All of the 44 women we interviewed said that without a subsidy, they could not work. That was a universal claim. Or they would say that the trade-offs in meeting their family's basic needs would be disastrous. They often referred to the mandate that they be self-sufficient, and they were quite clear. Without a subsidy for child care, they could not meet this mandate, something that they, too, aspire to. Clearly, work supports, such as child care assistance, are still imperative. And, of course, that's something that we recognized a decade ago when we were making an effort to move families from welfare to work. And it's still critically important today. So let me give you two examples from women we spoke with who said the following when we asked them what would they do if they did not have a child care subsidy, and you have more quotes on the policy brief I gave you. But Rachel, who has three children, said, without assistance for child care, I wouldn't be able to work. I'd have to stop working, basically. I'd have to quit my job, and then I'd be back at the same. It'd be like, I can't work because I can't pay child care. My provider makes something like $1,500 a month off of my boys, and I could not pay $1,500. I don't make that much a month, so I'd have to stop working. And Mary, who also has three children, told us, I could work, but I'd be living out of a box or my car. Because how do you pay rent and pay daycare? If you have two kids, you're looking at $1,100 to $1,200 a month in childcare. How do you do that and work, especially as a single mom? If I didn't have a childcare subsidy, we'd be living out of a cardboard box. And I'm glad that we do have the childcare subsidy. So then I can work and do what I'm supposed to do. I want to provide you with one story that illustrates quite vividly what might happen if we were to eliminate the subsidy for 2,900 working parents in Oregon. And this is Julia's story. She's the parent of three children. Two are school age and one is a preschool age child. And she was self-employed cleaning apartments for landlords between tenants. When tenants move out, she would do the deep cleaning necessary before the next tenant. And she built up quite a decent clientele and was getting enough jobs to make ends meet. She reported to us that in the year prior, she had made about $12,000. And her mother took care of her children. She said, I started working 3 years, and I started at first arranging my schedule around my kids' school hours, which worked, but then I was losing jobs by doing it that way. And then it got to the point where I would pick my kids up from the bus, and I would take them to work, and I'd end up working 2 or 3 hours longer. And the interviewer asked to clean up after your kids, and she said, yeah. And then she said, one time we walked into this place, and somebody had broken in, and I'm like, this is not safe for you guys. So that was when I talked to my mom, and we've been good in child care ever since. So Julia needed extremely flexible hours. She worked on demand and often worked evenings and weekends. Of course, she worked days too. And her mother was willing to come to her house whenever she was needed. And she tended to provide care 20 to 50 hours a week for Julia, highly variable hours. In our first interview with Julia, she remarked that if she lost her subsidy, she was confident that her mother would provide the care, continue to provide the care without the subsidy. But then she did lose her subsidy because she was self-employed, and on April 1st last year, self-employed recipients of this subsidy could no longer receive it, and her mother stopped providing the care because she could not afford to do so without pay. Since then, Julia struggled to find care. When she could, she paid friends and her mother out of pocket for her child care. She left her older child alone, and in our first interview, she had explicitly said she would never choose to do that because Julia had had a boyfriend who had stalked her, and she did not feel it was safe to leave her children home alone. Now she was leaving her 12-year-old home. She would split the younger two up and send them to friends, do whatever she could to get the care she needed. The loss of that subsidy meant that Julia's employment was at grave risk, and her children were no longer in stable, safe arrangements. For her, this was a devastating blow to her previously stable life as a low-wage, self-employed worker, and it was also a blow to her self-esteem. She said in our interview, "I built this business, something I built out of nothing. I didn't have a dime to my name. This is more than work. This is who I am. I make clean for a living, and a lot of people look down on this, but I don't get child care, and I don't get child support." So I also want to conclude with my gratitude in your investment and your concern about this, and to say that, of course, ERDC really is critically important to helping low-wage workers maintain their employment in this state. And without that child care subsidy, I think we can guarantee there will be families losing their employment, and there will be children in much more difficult circumstances than they are currently in. So thank you for your attention to this matter.
Thank you very, very much. Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ellen, on the change last year on eliminating self-employed persons, was that, how did that rule change come about? Was it legislative or administrative? What was the change?
Let's see. I turned our experts in the room. You're on deck. It was legislative. I do the interviews. They run the program.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Representative Witt and members of the committee. Thank you so much. My name is Deborah Murray, and I'm the Executive Director of Peninsula Children's Center in North Portland. Peninsula Children's Center has existed for almost 40 years now. We'll be celebrating our anniversary next fall, and has always been, it's a nonprofit, and it is a state-licensed center-based program. It's always been committed to the idea of helping low-wage earners that live in North and inner Northeast Portland to be able to maintain their jobs and have their children in a place where they can not only be safe and healthy, but that they can actually thrive. I'm here today to talk to you from three different perspectives. First, as a provider of care. Second, as a major employer in North Portland. And third, as a person who has been involved in early childhood education professionally for 35 years. First, as a provider, I've provided you a story written by one of our current families. Nina came to us after having already lost her children to the foster care system because of domestic violence and substance abuse. She was on TANF in 2006 and went through a process of trying to pull her life back together. She's done that successfully. She's now a single mother with three children under the age of five. And she's very proud of the fact that through the processes that she went through, she now has what she defines as a really good job. She's a medical assistant at St. Vincent's Hospital in Southwest Portland, and she brings home $1,800 a month. For her, that is success, and she's very proud of herself. Her child care bill is over $2,000 a month. She can't pay it, and I can't afford to do it in a state-licensed program for anything less. That's the reality of what we're talking about here as the tension point. As far as being an employer, I'm as amazed as anyone to discover that with 35 full-time employees and four or five substitutes, on-call people that come in to help in our year-round program, that I'm considered a medium to major employer in North and Northeast Portland. North and Northeast Portland is one of the most diverse communities in the city, both in terms of socioeconomic levels and also in terms of racial levels. The employees that we have at the center reflect that diversity. We have a very diverse parent body. We have about, I think at this point, we have about 39% African-American children, about 4% Hispanic, and the rest either mixed or Caucasian kids. And our staff represents that. What I do know is that of our key staff, four of them are single mothers who have their children at our center because they get ERDC. And they have all told me that if they lost their child care subsidy, that they could not work for me. These are staff that are working on professional development. They started as teaching assistants, and they're now lead staff through other programs that we've been able to access. They're working on higher education. They're all working on their associate's degrees. They're not just doing this because they can't think of anything else to do. They're doing it because they're committed to the children that they take care of, and they're committed to child care as a profession. If we knock the props out from under them, we lose many times over. I lose them as employees. They lose the self-respect and the sense of professionalism that they're developing. And the parents that rely on them, the other parents that rely on them to care for their children, lose people who are really doing a very good job. Finally, I can tell you, as someone who has worked in early childhood education for the last 35 years, that in our early childhood program, we also have two school-age programs, that we currently have 33 families that are on ERDC, and that represents 45 children who are in our center on ERDC benefits. Our center is licensed for 92 children. So we have almost half of the children that are there that are coming from low-income families. Many of them are coming from high-risk, low-income families. And what I can tell you, as part of other programs that we've been able to fund through grants and other supports, that we're very proud of the fact that when we do quarterly assessments on all the children in the building, that 95% of our children are performing at their appropriate developmental milestones and developmental levels. And of the 5% who aren't, we've been able to get them attached to the Multnomah County Educational Service District, speech and language therapy, other kinds of mental health supports. And so we know that all of those kids, when they leave us at the age of 5 and a half and hit the public school system, are ready to learn. They are the children that all of us are trying to address in terms of the achievement gap. They have the best chance of making it. The other thing that we know, as Bobby and Ellen were saying, is that for every dollar we invest in early childhood education at this point in time, depending on the study that you look for, we reap the benefit of $7 to $12 in the long term in terms of drug and alcohol abuse, teenage pregnancy, unemployment, juvenile justice, the whole list of things that we all care deeply about as leaders in our community. I can also tell you that early childhood education and the success of entering school ready to succeed is one of the key factors for breaking the cycle of poverty in the next generation. So what we know is that we're helping primarily single mothers. The list of what Bobby was talking about in terms of numbers is hugely overrepresented by single moms. They're breaking the cycle of poverty because of the support of employment-related daycare. And when employment-related daycare is invested in quality child care programs that can make a difference in the lives of their children, we're breaking the cycle of poverty long term. So I'm here to ask you to please make sure, as we're going into the next session, and I know you have terrible decisions to make, but please understand that holding ERDC at current levels is one of the best ways we can invest in our state and address some of the other problems you're trying to balance budgets around. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Questions or comments for our panel? I took very seriously what you had to say about the prospect of 2,900 working families losing the ability to participate in the workforce. And I think we probably have a chicken and egg proposition here as to whether folks enter the workforce to support daycare or they have daycare to support their ability to be in the workforce. But whichever the case, this could have some very severe and significant impacts on our workforce, as well as the individual families that will lose an income. Apart from those long-term impacts, and the budget issues at hand that address those 2,900 working families. I'm going to ask you to take a broader look, and perhaps this is something that our subcommittee should invite you back for another hearing on this particular topic. But are there things that you think that we should be looking at as a subcommittee to better enable working families with children to be able to participate in the workforce as they would choose to do if they didn't face barriers with child care?
I think that's a really big question.
It is, and that's why...
And in order to frame an answer, we would love to be able to think about it and come back to you. I can tell you that in addition to being the executive director at Peninsula Children's Center, I'm also one of the governor-appointed commissioners on the Commission for Child Care at the state level. And this is something that, as a commission, we are wrestling with all the time, and that we are there to help try and form some of these ideas and to help you do your work. What I can tell you off the top of my head is that the other group of people that's in danger with these kinds of cutbacks are quality child care centers, because as I said, with over half of my children currently in this program, I wouldn't be able to continue in business if we lost half our enrollment and had no prospect of replacing that enrollment. Where families go when they leave us, as Ellen was saying, is a combination of family, friend, and neighbor care, whatever they can patch together, which tends to be cost less, which is a good thing, but much of it also tends to be unregulated and unsupervised in terms of the hit and miss of circumstances that parents have to put together. And so we also lose the quality at the top that Oregon has tried so hard to put in, and there are federal dollars now coming into the state to help support that, those quality improvements as well. So it is a complex question,
yes.
but we would love to look into it.
I, too, would hesitate to give you an offhand answer, but
certainly.
One thing I do want to mention that came up in the committee the other day when we testified, and it's hard to mention additional costs when you're struggling to keep a program intact without expanding it, but one of the senators on that committee mentioned the issue of families trying to get a higher education and child care not being available, subsidies are not available to cover it, the cost or the child care needed when one is in school. Now, you're struggling to keep a program intact for employment-related child care. He did raise this issue of it doesn't cover education, and of course, when somebody's getting a higher education, the probability that they're going to end up in a better job goes up dramatically. We know that. So it's an issue I would love to have on the table. I hesitate to throw a new cost item on the table when you're trying to salvage what you have. With regard to the bigger question about work supports, I mean, I would take seriously that question and like to come back to the committee with, I think it is a big question, and consulting our colleagues and people we work with who are advocates in the state is probably the best approach to responding to that, I would think.
I think that our subcommittee would benefit tremendously with you coming back if you would consider doing so and giving us a broader, more in-depth, perhaps a presentation on that larger issue. I think this is a critical aspect to workforce development, and if we don't address this as a subcommittee, I think we've lost an opportunity here to promote workforce development among an entire segment of our society that faces, well, I'm preaching to the choir obviously here, but just some of the most incredible challenges and barriers right now to being able to participate fully in the workforce. So I think that this is one of these we have to do it. We owe it to the public to hold that hearing. There have been many instances too on various topics that this subcommittee has dealt with that we time and again say, well, we should perhaps hold a joint hearing with the education committee as well. And so this may be another opportunity for us to do that. But if you're willing, I'd ask that maybe you work with our committee administrator, Teresa, to schedule something. And if there are additional witnesses that you think that would we would be well served to invite, I would love to do that. We could perhaps hold an entire hearing just on this one topic.
Jared, are you familiar with James Heckman's work on the role of early childhood for disadvantaged children as a workforce development strategy? Would that be of interest in this expanded question, or are you talking more specifically about current workforce members rather than the broader workforce development?
Well, I think our committee needs to concern itself with both, frankly. Okay. And I think that in terms of policy considerations, we may be looking at it at two different levels. But in terms of this subcommittee's charge, we absolutely need to address both of those.
Okay. I do appreciate the idea of thinking about a joint meeting with people from the education committee. I can tell you that one of our dilemmas is that with ERDC coming through the Department of Employment and the quality-related initiatives that are coming through the Department of Education, that child care is really caught in the middle, and that some other states that we've looked into that have really made incredible progress in both areas have been those states that have been able to look at braided funding and being able to spread the limited funds that they do have in a way that benefits children across the board. One of the things that keeps Peninsula in the place where it is that we're not just serving the low-income workers, but we're really community-based, and we've got a blend of families from the lowest income through two-family double incomes who are paying the full cost of care. They demand the quality.
Yes.
And it's the low-income families and the low-income children who most benefit from that quality. So some merging of that is a really good idea.
Uh-huh. Very good. Thank you.
Chairwick, could I just ask a clarifying question?
Please do.
My understanding is that you are asking not just for more information about daycare as a workforce support, but also other forms of work supports for single-parent families. Is that correct, or did I misunderstand?
No, we would be most interested in the broader broader review of the issues that impact
work supports in general.
Yes,
okay, thank you.
Absolutely, and quite frankly, I think we've, up until your presentation, missed the boat on a critically important aspect of workforce development. And we need to do this. We need, as a subcommittee, to get our feet wet on this topic, because it is impossible for us to be making policy decisions and ignoring an entire segment of our society that faces such tremendous challenges. So, Representative Dembrough, did you have...
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the direction that you've taken this conversation, because I think that the need to look at the areas of overlap and really shared purpose on this issue from the education front and the workforce development front, I think it's really essential. Vice Chair Huffman and I serve on the Education Committee, and I think that it would really be useful for us to be looking at this as an education issue at the same time as a workforce development issue.
Right.
Let me say, I don't know if you know, but my day job, when I'm not doing this, is I teach at Portland Community College's Cascade campus, very close to the Peninsula Center. And many of the students that you're talking about are probably, they may be my students, in fact. And I can.
We have a scholarship program with PCC Cascade that we have many families at our center that are attending there.
Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, I've had a number of students who are able to be working on transforming their lives because of ERDC. And
I've had the unfortunate experience of students who've told me that they have had that they were going to have to drop out of school because they were losing their ERDC, mm-hmm. and they were headed back into TANF, mm-hmm. and or maybe they had never been on TANF, but they were that was the route that they were going to take, and it was really debilitating to their self-esteem. I think you referenced that, and it not to mention the impact. Potential impact of that on their children. These things are really very much interrelated, and I really appreciate your comments about that.
Vice Chair Huffman.
I believe Representative Holby was next.
Okay.
Oh, thank you. Actually, part of my question has already been asked, and I was just also curious about the ERDC funds, and maybe you, and I apologize if I missed this and you said it when I wasn't paying attention or wasn't here, but I was curious about the ERDC funds in general. I mean, the state, some of that's federal and some of it's yes. state.
Substantially federal.
And so if we cut state funding, we... lose a match, and it'd be interesting to know what those figures are.
I'm sure that's a mandatory match, discretionary funding, child care development fund is complicated,
yeah.
but yes, we this big a cut does put us at risk.
Right, and beyond that, just following up on the way the conversation that the chair has started this out with the how this impacts not just people that need to find a job, but also impacts education, trying to braid some of these services. I do have to comment about the early childhood intervention because I've spent a little bit of time with some of those programs, just examining them and seeing what a difference they make for families, as well as you mentioned how much that saves us in drug and alcohol and all these other things, but it also saves our school districts tons of money in future educational costs, which is one of the biggest savings that I could see. Besides, I have my daughter-in-law is going through this same sort of trial and tribulation right now with a one-year-old and potentially leaving the workforce because of the child care costs. She's in another state, so I can't really help her too much. But, but she's also considering going back to school to upgrade her skills. And it is a struggle for families, and the whatever we can do to help mitigate the economic impacts to folks and trying to take care of their children and provide them a better future is well worth it. So I really applaud your area of interest and expertise in trying to do something about this problem. I'm really excited that the chair wants to look into this further. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Please, Chair Huffman, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deborah, as a commission member, you might be able to answer this, or it might be more for Kathleen, I don't know, but what is the state policy? You had mentioned that a lot of your clients are single mothers.
Mm-hmm.
Absentee fathers, when the father is known, what is state policy about trying to get some of the costs of child care back from the father?
I'd have to look into it a little bit more, and certainly the progress that has been made in terms of tracking down fathers who aren't helping to pay child support. But what I can tell you is that especially when we're talking about this low-income population, even the child care support that an absent father might be able to add to the family, and I can tell you that just talking to the moms that we work with every day, that is intermittent at best, and it's not something that they can count on, isn't enough to really address the whole problem. It's certainly a small piece of it, and that level of accountability is really important, but these families still need help from the community at large in order to be participating members in the community.
DHS representatives are in the audience if you wanted a specific answer to exactly how they bring together child support enforcement and
I'm seeing
ERDC.
Smiles back there.
Yeah.
And I think I probably know the answer to my question.
And what you can do is maybe send you some additional information. I'm making a list of things.
Great. So. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. A follow-up comment. You know, in relationship to my question and the need to find balance, I happen to have a constituent that is in a frustrated situation where he recognizes and desires to pay child support, but he was unemployed and got behind. The DA for the county or somebody took his driver's license because he was in arrears on child support, and now he has no transportation. And so I've tried to work with the DA to no avail to go to explain the situation. They say, hey, we have rules. Yeah, we need rules, but sometimes we need a little dose of common sense, too, to figure out that if you have a willing worker, and under the current economic circumstances, they're unemployed, but they would certainly travel, and it's in a rural area. There's no bus service to get him to the job. I mean, it's just, so, wanted to throw that out on the record.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. To answer your question in somewhat, Representative Huffman, is why do they call it common sense when it's so uncommon?
Additional questions or comments for our panel? Professor Scott, I'm not going to let you go without making the comment how what a difference your department has made in terms of education. My daughter is a senior now at the U of O. She thought she wanted to be a politician, and then she found meaning in her life. that was in your department.
Which hat are you referring to? I have two department hats on my head.
Oh, I'm sorry, women's studies.
Oh, okay.
And she had never been exposed to that curriculum before. And has found that so important that she now wants to go on to law school and focus on women's issues and protection of women's rights.
Well, give her my regards. I'm not around this year because I'm on sabbatical doing research with Bobby, but it's a pleasure to know that your daughter is here.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you all for your time today.
And certainly appreciate your willingness to come back and educate us further. And I would ask Teresa, if you'd work with our panel members as well as Vice Chair Huffman and Representative Holvey to try and do something jointly with Representative Dembro with the Education Committee. Mm-hmm. So with that, thank you so very, very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Any comment from the general public on employment related daycare at this point? Seeing none, I'm going to close the informational meeting on employment-related daycare. Teresa, any housekeeping items at this point that you can think of?
No, Mr. Chair. I do have an update on what's going on with LC-117.
Okay.
It is being fixed. So if all goes well with timeframes and such, the fix will be in the original bill that will be introduced in February.
Wonderful.
With the Speaker's permission, of course. And to follow up on the House Bill 3600 conversation, Representative Green, look, I will check with counsel on that sort of statutory reference and as to why that's in the bill. So I'll send that out once I know what the answer is.
Wonderful. And with that, if there's nothing for the good of the order, we will stand adjourned. See you all in February.
All right.
Thank you very much, committee members.